Are you eating enough to get faster? Welcome to the Science of Getting Faster podcast, where we cut through the headlines, talk directly to the researchers to find out what their studies suggest, what they don't, and where their research is heading. With us on the podcast today, we have Dr. Jose Arita. Welcome to the podcast, Jose.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Thanks for coming on. So today we're going to be talking about energy availability and its importance for endurance athletes. So let's dive right in. And Dr. Arita, could you explain what is energy availability and how do we measure it?
Yeah, well, energy availability is a concept that really has developed through time. Nowadays, you know, in the era of sports science, if you talk about sports nutrition, let's say you talk about energy availability, what people would understand that is the energy, like the dietary energy that you normally would have available to maintain your normal physiology. You subtract the exercise energy expenditure. So mathematically speaking, it's a very sort of simple idea or concept. So that would be energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure. And typically we standardize that to fat-free mass. So the part of your body that is not fat, because fat is considered to be the sort of metabolically inert tissue. So it's more relevant what energy you have available to your lean mass. Even mathematically speaking, it's a sort of a simple concept. When it comes to the calculation of energy availability, it's a completely different thing. There's a lot of challenges that come with trying to get a real value of what it seems to be, deceivingly simple concept.
Yeah, definitely. And so we think we're tracking our, at least our energy expenditure using our like smart devices or power meters. How accurate are those for measuring energy availability?
Yeah, well, the thing is like when it comes to measuring energy intake and energy expenditure, we know that the vast majority of devices that we can use have a huge error. So they are neither accurate nor reliable in the majority of the cases. So there's a whole number of issues with also tracking energy intake. So, but let's think about more, exercise energy expenditure. That's what the direct question that you're asking me about. And I suppose for the sake of the population that this podcast is aimed at, most people are interested in like power meters and how good are the power meters to measure energy expenditure. So I'd say, it's very different if you use some sort of like device that you wear in your wrist that is going to give you an estimate of energy expenditure. There's huge error in these devices. So in general, I wouldn't use them as a way to have an idea of what my energy expenditure might be like. However, some devices that measure directly the amount of mechanical power that we're producing, such as power meters, so like a crank-based power meter or pedal-based power meter or a hub-based, whichever one you like, they're a lot better for having an idea of what your energy expenditure is. However, what you have to keep in mind is that these devices measure mechanical power, so it measures the amount of kilojoules that you do. Behind that sort of mechanical power, you have your engine, your metabolism that is generating energy, which has a degree of efficiency, right? So we know, people typically have about like 20-something% efficiency in terms of like how much metabolic power is translated into mechanical power. But there's variation. So if you don't measure the exact efficiency of an individual, there's always some degree of underestimation, overestimation of using these devices to estimate exercise energy expenditure. But let's say from all the different tools that are out there to do to measure specific exercise energy expenditure, they are pretty good.
Okay, what about, I know most of our athletes are cyclists, but we do have a surprisingly large amount of runners, as we've recently discovered with the ability to import runs now into Trainer Road. What about the accuracy of running power meters? Are they more accurate or less accurate than, say, just measuring through GPS or heart rate?
Yeah. So the thing with running power meters, and here I must say that I'm not aware exactly about how this technology works. I'm not that familiar with those. It's definitely not a direct measurement of mechanical power, as the way that I understand they work is mainly with accelerometers and sort of tracking, you know, the difference in how the body is accelerating and, you know, stride length and acceleration and so on. So it's more like an estimation of power, whereas cycling power meter is a direct measurement of the force exerted in the strain gauges of the device. So to be honest, I'm not familiar with like any sort of serious research looking at the how accurate and reliable these devices are. And I suppose these things are quite hard to test in the lab because it would be quite different being on a treadmill than being outside, I believe. But my guess, and this is some sort of educated guess, let's say, is that the estimates wouldn't be as accurate or possibly not as reliable as well.
Okay. And so if we're thinking about optimal energy availability for endurance athletes, what is the threshold? What are we trying to aim for?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very nice question, and it's a question that we encounter quite often, because there's this widespread idea that there's this sort of ideal level of energy availability, and once you drop under a specific value, then, you know, some things might not start working the way they should in terms of like physiology and so on. And, you know, conceptually is very nice, you know, if we think that maybe we have like this single value that we can measure, and then we know that if you are under specific value, then things are wrong, and if we are above that, it's right. Unfortunately, things are not as simple, and it's not as black and white. What you will encounter a lot in the literature and overall in the discussion in this topic is that there is this threshold of energy availability of 30 kilocalories per kilo of fat free mass per day. So that is the way we sort of measure energy availability. As I said before, energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure normalized to fat-free mass. And we think that whether, you know, you increase exercise energy expenditure or decrease energy intake or a combination of both can be a way in which you sort of diminish energy availability. So, you know, based on a range of studies based in the lab of short duration of about, you know, 3 to 6 days, using mainly female sedentary population, what has been shown is that under this threshold of 30 kilocalories per kilo of fat-free mass per day over a few number of days, there's some sort of hormonal changes that are associated to this sort of energy availability. Or decrease in energy availability. And the thing is that, you know, the changes that happen in these hormones make the sort of the hormonal milieu, so the circulating hormones, look a lot like what happens with female athletes with amenorrhea. Yeah, so there is this sort of hormonal shift. There's like a physiological response that makes the hormones of females look more like those of females with amenorrhea that have amenorrhea. For, you know, the listeners who don't know what that is the lack of a menstrual cycle, which is one of the things that seem to be affected by not eating enough energy. But that there is a gap between saying that, you know, maybe that level of energy availability produces like a hormonal shift to the fact that, well, that is not necessarily adequate. There's a lot of things that we don't know. For example, how long you need to have that level of energy availability until it produces a sort of a measurable effect. What happens if you do it intermittently? What happens with people that exercise more and so on? There's a number of things that we don't really know about this.
Okay. So when you say that it's not quite as simple as determining that, I think you said, was it 30 kilocalories?
Yes, per exactly.
Kilogram.
Per kilo of fat-free mass per day. Yes.
Yes. Okay. So also with endurance athletes, I saw that you had written a paper about the day-to-day variability on endurance athletes' energy availability. And I assume that has to be something that is hard to measure with endurance athletes in the rather than being in the lab on the field or in the field because of our training looks very different from a day-to-day basis. So does that complicate how we establish a threshold as well?
Yeah, so to bring the listeners in on the same page as us, for them to understand a little bit what we actually did. You know, I had a suspicion that this was a case we're doing with athletes. So we set to look a little bit at, you know, what happens day to day in a specific group of athletes. These were elite level road cyclists that we look at what happens day to day in their energy availability. And we tracked energy intake using a methodology that is called like remote food photography method, you know. In lay terms, this would basically be taking photos of your food, and then we do a quantification of that. And we did that for a number of days. So we did that for 7 days in a row with 10 cyclists. It's quite, you know, I'd say complicated for a number of reasons. First of all, because it's a burden for the athletes. So we were doing this as part of the work with the athletes. So they were getting something back because we start, you know, getting a better idea of what they are doing or not doing with their nutrition. And then, you know, most of the data in terms of energy expenditure is very easy with cyclists because we can get it or estimate it quite well from the power meters. We know that there's error in both of these measurements. So the energy intake, there's error. So there's what we call like systematic error and random error. And typically what happens is like we underestimate how much energy people eat. So the challenges are more so related to the methodologies of measuring energy intake. That is the variable that tends to have most error. And this is not something that an individual could do, you know, if they're tracked, their diet is not something that is impossible. But I think most people and, you know, most endurance athletes and, you know, triathletes and so on, and which are, you know, type A personality and sort of want to control everything in the nutrition and so on, and go like, oh, I want to go there and know exactly my energy availability because I want to have the best performance that I can. But at the same time, I'll see if I can shave off a couple of kilos of my body weight and perform better. You know, most people have these ideas in the head. I believe, having worked with a number of endurance athletes myself, and me being for a number of years an endurance athlete. But, you know, it's not that easy because, you know, we know there's error, and also you cannot track it for the whole year, right? You can do it for a number of days and then you see what happens for a number of days, but sooner or later, you're going to lose track of what's going on. So yeah, it's, you know, to simplify the answer to you, yes, it's quite challenging, and methodologically it's demanding and challenging as well.
Yeah. The idea of taking photographs to quantify how much an athlete is eating, that seems like, from a type A person myself, it seems less burdensome than, say, measuring how much exactly in terms of the weight of the food. How accurate are you able to get those estimations, do you think?
Yeah, well, there's a number of studies looking into this. The exact percentages, I don't have them on top of my head. I can tell you that the typical ways of recording energy intake have typically a systematic bias of about like 20%. So it's just like 20% underreporting, which for some people might not sound a lot, but it is a lot in terms of percentage, more so when you start to try to quantify energy availability. And, you know, of the three parameters that we use, energy intake, exercise, energy expenditure, And fat-free mass energy intake is the one that would contribute the most to the overall calculation. So, you know, if you have a large error on that, probably your value is going to be off. So what am I trying to say here is that it's not a completely useless parameter to measure or to assess, but I think it's got to be taken with a grain of salt, so to speak, and have an idea, you know, roughly where you are, but it wouldn't be a value that I sort of attach to and say like, oh, you know, my energy availability today is of 29.5, therefore I'm in low energy availability, and that is terrible. It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, definitely. Looking specifically at endurance sports, what is the prevalence of low energy availability?
Yeah, well, that's definitely an answer that we don't have because we cannot really, there's a number of problems here. So I think when some of the main concerns are more than energy availability per se is that it is thought that energy availability or low energy availability is the cause and the root cause of a number of sort of physiological dysregulations. As I was saying before, we don't really know exactly what low energy availability is like, is, you know, how long you need to be at a certain value. And we have problems assessing this value. We don't know if we can rely in this value to say, oh, someone is slow or moderate or adequate or high or whatever. So because we cannot define that, we can also not define, you know, what the prevalence is. And then you would say, oh, because we cannot really rely on that value, what else can we look at? Well, we can look at a number of hormones, for example, that might change when you are not consuming enough energy relative to the amount of exercise that you do. And so we know that, for example, hormones that tend to be quite responsive to this low energy availability are, I don't know, let's say leptin, or you can say like IGF-1. You know, it seems that in males, testosterone is quite sensitive to it, even though there's not so much research on it. But we know that endurance athletes tend to have like low testosterone levels in general. And there's a number of, you know, a range of hormones that get affected. Also, resting metabolic rate, so the amount of energy that you use at rest seems to decrease with low energy availability and so on. And then you go like, oh, great. Now I know that these hormones are something that I can measure and it's going to give me an idea whether, you know, I haven't eaten enough. Well, the thing is that when you go out there and you try to measure these hormones and you measure it in an individual, again, you encounter the problem of measurement error. And the thing is that in the majority of the cases, I wouldn't say in all the cases, in many, many cases with low energy availability or like not eating enough energy, it seems that these hormones change, but they don't go below what it would be a clinical value. So you go to your doctor, you get your hormones measured, and the majority of the case, you go like, oh, yeah, look, it's a little bit low, but it doesn't seem to be under the threshold where me as a clinician, I'm going to be sort of concerned about. So this appears to be the case. I'm not saying, and of course, you shouldn't take my advice as that of a clinician. You have to check whatever you need to check with your clinician. I am not a clinician myself, but I'm aware that, you know, that the changes in these hormones are within a range that doesn't seem to raise any major flag. So when you're trying to say, you know, what sort of the prevalence of this is, you are finding yourself in this sort of difficult situation where you don't really have, in the majority of the cases, a very clear red flag that you go like, oh, because of this one thing, therefore I have this problem. So, but we know that certain physiological systems get affected more than others. And for example, in females, what it's a lot easier to spot, as I was mentioning before, is the lack of a menstrual cycle or let's say the alteration of a normal menstrual cycle. So the extreme, there's a continuum. In one end of the continuum, you have like normal menses. So every about, you know, 4 weeks, you get your menstrual bleeding and you get ovulation with that. And on the other side of the continuum, you have no menses at all. Assuming that we are working, for example, with a female athlete that is taking no oral contraceptives, that is not having any effect on the bleeding, menstrual bleeding, then if there is no menstruation, for example, that could be potentially taken as a red flag. That doesn't mean that this is called a secondary hypothalamic amenorrhea. And it seems that one of the causes of that is not having enough energy to the amount of energy expended, for example. So that is, you know, in many cases would raise a flag and I would go, okay, we need to investigate what's happening here, because that might lead to other things. We also know that bone turnover is affected. So one of the issues that seems to happen is bone mineral density decreases. So we have athletes, we have a high prevalence of stress fractures in athletes, for example, and female athletes in particular, like runners, not so much, of course, like cyclists, because there's not that much air, there's not impact in the sport. But these are things that are definitely red flags that need to be followed up. So if, you know, enough time happens where, you know, a female has no menstrual cycle, then this could potentially be impairing their health in relation to their bone metabolism. And it could be potentially a lot of other things that get affected as well, for which the evidence is not that strong at the moment. But it appears that maybe there are other things that get affected by it.
Yeah, definitely. Coming back to the female menstrual cycle, and this has been something that I've been pondering myself recently, was just by observing like my friends who are athletes, does having a menstrual cycle necessarily mean that you are achieving adequate energy availability? Or can you still have your menstrual cycle and have low energy availability?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a range of things that can happen. So it seems that not every female would be affected the same by a level of energy availability. So, you know, when we're talking about this sort of threshold value, one of the things that we don't know is whether if it's a universal value, and we think that is not. So it may be that there are some females that potentially are more resilient to it. Then, for example, you also have the issue that maybe a female is having oral contraceptives. So they have what is called like withdrawal bleeding, but it's not an actual menstrual bleeding. So you have bleeding there, but maybe they are not eating enough energy to maintain their normal physiological function. You can potentially have the case where you have bleeding, but there's no ovulation, which is an early sort of marker also of not consuming potentially enough energy. So you can also have a bleeding, but it's not you are what is called like oligomenorrheic. It's not the bleeding is not, it's not consistent with a around, you know, those four week periods. Maybe you bleed every 2 months, and then that is also a red flag.
Yeah, and you mentioned this, the sensitivity to low energy availability varying between individuals. I recently read Lauren Fleshman. I don't know if you know her. She's a famous runner, and she ran for Stanford and was a Nike-sponsored athlete. But she just released a book and called Good for a Girl. And she talks about this concept of differing ages and the impact that energy restriction may have on people at different points of their life. Is there an impact on, say, the age of an athlete and how low energy availability might affect them?
Yeah, that is a great question, actually. So there are different things to be considered. It seems that younger females, so you have a range, right? You have like, let's say, very junior athletes who haven't had their menarche, and they have like very high training load. So one of the things that you can have is potentially one of the things that we know that get affected by not having enough energy is growth. So it's a sort of a delay of puberty. So the menarche is delayed, right? It seems that females that are of a younger gynecological age, there are more sensitive to not having enough energy compared to females that are of an older gynecological age, in which case there seem to be potentially a little bit more resilient. In all cases, not having enough energy and this sort of suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary axis that would decrease the amount of estrogen, and that would have a knock-on effect on the level of bone synthesis, would happen across all ages, be it being severe enough. I would have potentially more of a concern also with postmenopausal women, because they do not have these sort of higher levels of estrogen, even in a normal state of energy availability, an optimal level of energy. So whether that would be, the effect would be more severe in older women, to be honest, I don't know, but I would be particularly careful.
Yeah. What about for men? Is there the same sensitivity for younger men?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, because historically this topic has been researched a lot more in females, mainly because it's a lot easier to spot when someone hasn't have enough energy because the menstrual bleeding stops. There's a lot less research in males. So the whole origin of the interest in this topic is around this thing called the Female Athlete Triad, which is a coalition, like a group of people from the US, which are doing really great work in this topic. And the Female Athlete Triad was this sort of thing that happened, you know, these three signs, you know, that happened coexisted in many cases in female athletes. It were eating disorders originally, low bone mineral density, and menstrual dysfunction. But originally was not, didn't know why it was, if it was the stress of exercise, if it was energy and so on. So the majority of the research was done in females, and then they discovered, oh, you know, energy availability has an effect. It's not exercise per se, but it's energy and so on. And then, oh, this only seems to affect females. And it was, you know, in the year, you know, in the 2000s, and so on, where they were like, hey, hang on, maybe something like this is happening males as well. Because there are seem to be some parallels, you know, between the, you know, what happens in female athletes and what happens in male athletes. So there are some studies showing that, you know, high training load in males is associated with lower testosterone levels and sort of lower sperm quality, like count and viability of sperm and so on. And it goes like, oh, this, you know, maybe affect males as well and stuff. And then this concept got sort of translated into another sort of model that is called the relative energy deficiency sport model, that goes like, well, this happens both in like males and females, and they are both like, you know, affected and so on. The thing is that we don't really have that much evidence to say like what happens on in males, and that's part of the work that we're doing, or the research that we're doing in my research group, trying to see what happens in males. Is that, do they get affected? Do they get affected the same? What actually changes and so on? And it seems that well, there are some endocrinological changes in males as well. Whether they are more or less sensitive than females, we don't know. Studies looking at both males and females, which, you know, there's only a couple of them, appear to indicate that males are a little bit more resilient to low energy availability. And when you look at some sort of epidemiological data, when you look at like prevalence of, for example, stress fractures in exercising population, this is a lot more common in females than in males. So about three times as common in females than in males. So it's not that it doesn't happen in males. In that case of epidemiological data, we cannot say it is because of the energy. But it seems that females are a lot more sensitive to it.
Yeah.
So we don't really have a threshold for males. So if this threshold of 30 kilocalories was developed in females, we can definitely, well, you know, based on the current evidence, it doesn't seem that we can't really apply it to males.
Right. So we'll look forward to that research for sure. When we think about the reasons for low energy availability in athletes, well, endurance athletes specifically, and even just comparing males versus females and how those reasons might differ, many of us are familiar with the huge problem of disordered eating and eating disorders in weight-dependent sports such as cycling and running and other endurance sports. When it comes to how often or is do you see athletes who struggle or suffer from low energy availability but aren't deliberately restricting their calories?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's a difficult one to tackle. So what happens that you can have low energy availability that happens inadvertently, let's say, because an athlete is training a lot and, you know, they're trying to eat certain types of foods but are not able to match their exercise energy expenditure with enough energy intake. Many of the athletes that suffer from these are athletes that in a way or another, they are trying to decrease their body weight. They are not happy with their body weight. And you have sort of the situation there of an eating disorder, or the eating potentially being the root cause of not having enough energy. So to be honest with you, in terms of like how you could split the prevalence between being one thing or the other that is creating the problem, I don't really know the exact split. I would be more concerned about someone who potentially has an eating disorder than anything for a range of issues. I am not a sports psychologist myself, and I don't feel qualified to, you know, make any recommendations in relation to eating disorders or anything like that. I focus more on the sort of strict physiological effects of not having enough energy. However, what we also need to be aware of is that eating disorders are not just an issue of not having enough energy, and there's potentially other things that might be complicated by the fact that they are associated with anxiety and depression, which in turn might have also an effect on the hypothalamic pituitary axis that do have an effect on the same things that low energy availability has. There is not really much research on this, but I think we have to consider that eating disorders themselves, beyond or maybe compounding the effect of not eating enough energy, could potentially have also an effect in dysregulating physiology.
Yeah, definitely. So if we think about then the impacts, if we focus in on the impacts on our physiology and the detriments to our health and performance, you mentioned earlier that there were some endocrine disruptions. Can we talk about what role does leptin play?
Okay. So I think here we need to be Can you maybe reword the question to make sure that I'm answering it the right way and give you information that you're after?
So when we think about, say, low energy availability affecting our hormonal response, how does, so leptin, you can correct me now, you're the expert, but leptin being an appetite or a hormone that affects our appetite, is that right?
Yes.
Yes. How does that become, how is that affected then when we are low in energy?
Okay. So here I think we need to be careful in maybe not becoming reductionist in saying, like, because, you know, one thing changed and that is associated to a specific sort of physiological response, then that's what's going to happen. Because we are a very complex system that, you know, sometimes they're like, oh, because leptin goes down, then you would expect, you know, appetite to go up and so on. The thing is, like, appetite is regulated by a range of hormones, not just leptin. So you have hormones that have a more of a long-term sort of regulation of appetite, like leptin, and then you have sort of more like day-to-day or within day, you know, ghrelin and so on, other hormones that respond more acutely to a physiological state and energy intake and so on. The thing is that making things more complex, how appetite is regulated by increased exercise or decreased energy intake is different. So, you know, you might see one hormone going in the same direction in both cases, but how the appetite regulation is different. So here, instead of having, you know, the approach of breaking it down hormone by hormone, which we could, and I could say, oh, you know, this hormone is associated with this and that hormone is associated with that. We have to be careful and, you know, look at it in a very much in a physiological integrative way to understand what is going on. Definitely leptin changes is one of the hormones that seem to be the most responsive to not having enough energy relative to the amount of energy that you are or your energy expenditure from exercise. And leptin is a hormone that is released by the adipose tissue and there's a direct relationship between the amount of body fat mass that you have and the concentration of leptin in your blood. The lower the amount of leptin, or let's say your leptin decreases, then your appetite is going to increase. The thing is that when you're not having enough energy, this sort of linear relationship between fat mass and circulating leptin changes because your leptin drops a lot quicker than there's any change before there's any changes in actual fat mass. So carbohydrate intake seems to be an important regulator of leptin, for example, and it seems potentially like carbohydrate availability might be a regulator of leptin. But I'm not sure if that's going down the path of the question they were trying to ask me.
Yeah, it was probably you're redirecting me in a good place now. So I think it's better if we approach it from, say, the point of view that how does our body adapt in a way to in response to the low energy availability, and what is it trying to do basically? So what is it? How is our body responding to this low energy availability, and what's the purpose of these responses?
Yeah. Okay. So what we need to think about is that we are a species that has developed to live in an environment where there's a availability of food that is not constant, that is different that in the world that we live in now, where we basically go to the fridge in the living room or whatever, you have a fridge, maybe in your bedroom, you know, or whatever, and then you open it and you have a nice, delicious, energy dense, highly palatable foods that is going to make you very happy. You know, our ancestors, the hunter gatherers, you know, 10,000 years ago didn't have that luxury. Luckily, we evolved systems to be able to, in periods of food scarcity, stay alive. So this means that we have a physiological response to not having enough energy. So our physiology, what it's doing is trying to preserve energy in different ways. That means that energy for systems that are not immediately essential for survival, such as growth and reproduction, get sort of suppressed, because these things, you know, if you are not having enough energy to stay alive, then really it's not that important that you use energy on those things. But maybe it's important that you use energy for things that are going to keep you alive and allow you to procure yourself from food. So what we are seeing is a physiological response for energy preservation, basically. And the changes in hormones that we see are changes that are trying to get hold of, you know, as much energy as possible, like to preserve the energy that we have and not use it for things that potentially are not going to increase our fitness for survival.
Yeah, definitely. And so you already mentioned that some of those responses, could you run through what kind of things are put on the back burner, basically, while we're trying to restore energy and just focus on being alive?
Yeah. So the hormonal responses that we see with not having enough energy seem to reduce energy allocated to reproduction, as I was saying before. So the menstrual cycle. So for example, having a child is a very energetically expensive process. So it costs about, I think, 70,000 calories to have a child. And this is something that probably, you know, is not, if you're not having enough energy to feed that child, is possibly protective to diminish the allocation of energy to a system that is going to be very, very energetically expensive in a period of food scarcity. Growth in general, you know, as I was saying before, it's been shown, you know, across populations in the world that if you're not having enough energy, the growth rate sort of per year, if you have a population that's not having enough energy, they're not growing as fast, or the growth sort of stalls. Also the sort of the anabolism in general in the body, you know, is reduced. One of them being protein synthesis, in particular, like muscle protein synthesis, and in particular the myofibrillar fraction of the muscle. It seems to be affected negatively by not having enough energy. So if you're trying to grow muscles, not eating enough energy doesn't seem to be the best idea. Of course, there's an important, you have to consider what you're eating. It's not just the energy, because it seems that increasing protein intake allows you to maintain that sort of muscle mass in the face of energy deficiency. As I was saying before, bone metabolism gets affected as well. That's quite seems to be quite clear. This is a bit tricky because bone is, you know, you think it of a tissue that doesn't really change, because it's this sort of hard, solid tissue that doesn't seem as responsive as a skeletal muscle, for example. But it's quite clear that in the long term, it does get affected. When we do measurements of markers of bone metabolism in blood, we can look at things that change in your blood, sort of metabolites that change in your blood, that gives us an indication of what's happening with collagen. And we relate that, we use that marker of collagen synthesis to bone synthesis and resorption. And there's evidence showing that not having enough energy increases markers of bone resorption and decreases markers of bone formation. So bone is this tissue that has this it's a balance between the synthesis and the resorption. And when there's not enough energy, it appears that this has been thrown out of balance. Interestingly, you know, and this is some of the things that our lab group is researching, we don't really know that well what's happening with muscle quality. So you think about, oh, you know, all these things get downregulated and there's all these sort of negative effects of having low energy. And of course, you have low energy for a period that is long enough. And then that might mean that you have a bone that is so weak that it's going to break while you're exercising. But, you know, before you get to this sort of breaking point, there might be other things that happen metabolically that might not be maybe as negative. And if we think about what happens in skeletal muscle and the sort of the metabolic response of skeletal muscle, it might be that it's either maintained or potentially, who knows, even improved. We have, you know, evidence of top level athletes or particular female athletes who do not have a menstrual cycle, for example, and are performing at the highest level. That doesn't mean by any chance that not bleeding has to be an aim of a top athlete. But the only thing that I'm saying is that there is a reallocation of limited resources, and potentially skeletal muscle, when it comes to oxidative capacity, might not be affected as negatively. Having said that, you also have to keep in mind that if you're not eating enough energy, probably you're not eating enough carbohydrates. And if you're not having enough carbohydrates, you're not going to have enough muscle glycogen. And we know that muscle glycogen is a very, very important energy source for athletes of pretty much any sport. But, you know, for any sport that requires high intensity, and, you know, cycling has is very stochastic in nature. And you have periods of increases of intensity that require that muscle glycogen. So if you're not having enough carbohydrates, your performance most likely is going to suffer.
Yeah, and that actually brings me to a point that of longevity in sport. And I think something that's particularly problematic in endurance sports is we see highly successful athletes, and many of us try to emulate what they did to get to success. And at least I see this in the college system as a lot of short-term success, and probably likely due to the reasons you're saying, that perhaps performance isn't directly impacted at the muscular or aerobic level. But then in the long term, these athletes, many of which don't have a long career, due to issues with, injuries or illness and increased susceptibility to, other things that always go wrong with our bodies. Our bodies aren't, perfect, and it's harder to fight those off. And how does, I think then my question then leading into that is what are the long-term implications of these? And can someone, if they've been in a chronic state of low energy availability, is it always possible to recover, or is there damage that you can do that is almost irreversible?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something that it requires a lot more work to have a definite answer. I have some answers to what you're saying and, you know, some reflections as well. As you were saying, you know, a lot of people think that because not eating enough energy is associated to so many potentially negative things, that one of the things that is going to be affected early on is performance. And the thing is that, well, performance, if it is affected, doesn't seem to be, you know, the thing that gets affected first. So if you're waiting for a decrease in performance to say that you're eating enough, it's probably not the right focus, potentially. It might be affected, but it wouldn't be the first thing that I expect to be affected. But there might be, you know, some other things in the background that are really going to cause trouble. As you were saying, it's something that might, to some extent, or depending on the situation, be more of an irreversible thing, such as bone and bone fractures. Again, I'm not an expert in bone metabolism, but you know, when you look at the epidemiological data and the prevalence of bone fractures and what they cause, it really is a concern. So I would say that really is a topic of concern. Whether the menstrual dysfunction is something that is a problem that is irreversible, I don't think there is enough data or convincing data to say that your, you know, for a female, for example, the capacity to conceive necessarily is going to be affected. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm saying I'm not aware of, and if someone knows of any data that I'm not aware of, I would love to know about. I know about some ongoing research in this topic that suggests that maybe it is the case that it creates more of a long-term negative effect. But there is also evidence showing that when fueling enough or for enough and long enough for an for amenorrheic individuals, menses seem to resume. Have a nice case study that published on this a couple of years ago with a female cyclist showing resumption of eumenorrhea with concomitant increase in body weight and body fat mass. That seems to be related to an increase in the energy availability, even though we didn't really measure these. And there's more experimental data from sort of randomized control trials showing that that's possibly the case. So in terms of irreversible problems, you know, the main thing that comes to my head is potentially what could happen to bone. Other things, I'm not so sure. So we know that one of the things that maybe get affected by not eating enough energy might be sort of iron metabolism and whether anemia is causing any long-term effects. To be honest, I'm not fully aware. I'm not fully familiar with this, but it's something that definitely deserves more research in the future to understand what really is going on. As I was saying before, I believe that these responses are potentially a physiological response to try to survive to things that are not immediately essential for survival. And it's a physiological response that, you know, it's potentially been adaptive to keep you alive, but potentially it's not something that you want to maintain over a long period of time because you might have these sort of negative effects.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know if the, like we had mentioned earlier about the gynecological age of an athlete and whether that has an impact on the long-term implications. So say if they were younger when they were restricting energy, does that then have a more severe impact long-term? I'd be really curious.
Yeah, one of the things that it seems that to happen in female athletes, for example, that have indicators of not having had enough energy for early years in their life is that they never reach sort of peak bone mass. So bone mass, you know, is sort of some sort of indicator of the amount of bone. It's not necessarily indicative of the quality or the structure of the bone, but you know, this sort of increase gets a peak and then it only goes down sort of thing. And this sort of peak level never gets, or expected peak level never gets achieved. You know, if someone in the early stages of their life is not eating enough energy. So, of course, it's going to potentially have an effect later on in their life. So for, you know, athletes that early on are not having enough energy, they think, well, it doesn't matter, you know, I just want to go faster, you know, perform better and so on. But they're not really thinking about, as you're saying, about their longevity or what might happen in the later year in their lives.
Yeah, and I think perhaps particularly dangerous with younger athletes because their brain is not fully formed. So they are not quite able to like think long-term and have a clear perspective on the implications. So when we're, if an athlete is concerned about having low energy availability, what are the early warning signs that you would suggest people be aware of?
I think here we go back to this issue that we have that if we cannot really diagnose it that easily. I think these days it's such a big topic in sports nutrition, and it's been associated to so many or implicated in so many dysregulations that anything that is remotely indicative of some sort of normal, you know, of normal physiology being affected is associated to low energy availability. So I think that we need to be, you know, aware that, you know, it's not the only thing that exists in terms of what can affect to an athlete. One of the things that I would be particularly aware is whether someone is likely to be in the sort of demographics that are most affected by this. And so you were saying before, being in a sport that is where weight plays an important role in the performance, as well as looking at the, you know, drive to be thinner, to be leaner, and so on. So potentially, you know, markers of eating disorders or disordered eating and so on. So what I'm saying here is that symptoms and signs are not necessarily easy to detect. As I was saying, you get a blood, you know, sample, and you get all these like panel, you know, all these parameters measured in the blood, and they not really tell you much. You get an RMR assessment, you know, and maybe something that people do is look at what is called like RMR ratio. So the relationship between the resting metabolic rate that you measure and the one that you would predict. And if it's 10% off from that value, that might be an indicator as well. But, you know, RMR is a quite noisy measurement that can easily be 10% off in the one off measurement. So I wouldn't say there is the one single thing. What it's very typical with many athletes is they are under eating carbohydrates. So most athletes, if you look at the, you know, if you go out and measure like 200, 300, as many hundred endurance athletes, you'd like to measure, in the vast majority of the cases, you will find that they are not having enough carbohydrates according to the carbohydrate and dietary guidelines. This is for a range of issues. It could be, you know, fear of carbohydrates, or it could be like lack of knowledge or like logistical problems and so on. So if, you know, I am an athlete and I'm concerned potentially about how far off I might be with my energy, I necessarily wouldn't be going out there counting every single calorie, but mostly be concerned about what am I doing with my carbohydrate intake. And when this is taken care of, a lot of things start to fall in place, actually. So first of all, that, I mean, this is not necessarily the way everyone will do it and everyone want to do it. I suppose every nutritionist will have their approach. I don't know, but this is a way that is easy to start working with someone to try to understand how far off are from their dietary guidelines. And this is particularly important for endurance athletes, for whom carbohydrate intake is so important in the majority of the cases.
Yeah. Do you have a recommendation as to how much carbohydrate an endurance athlete should be aiming to get?
Well, it really depends on the training of the athlete. It can vary anywhere. So high carbohydrate availability can be achieved with anywhere between 3 grams per kilo per day to 12 grams per kilo per day. And this depends on the intensity and duration of training. So if you have a day with which, you know, you have your athletes not training at all, then somewhere between 3 to 5 grams per kilo per day will be more than enough. And if you have a day where an athlete is training 4 to 5 hours of high intensity, then you might be have to aim at 12 grams per kilo today, per day, for which, you know, most athletes have no idea what this looks like, and it's a lot of food.
Yeah, 12 grams of that's a lot of carbohydrates. I can't even fathom how I would fit that into my day.
Yeah, it's a lot of food. The things with carbohydrates that are particularly, in general, they are not energy dense. unless you go down the path of using more like refined sugars and so on, in which, you know, you can get them, you can pack a lot more in a lot less weight or volume.
Yeah, definitely. If we're like thinking about steps towards regaining adequate energy availability, if we've been in a place of low energy availability, how do we reverse engineer so that our resting metabolic rate, we can optimize that again? Is it something that's a gradual change, or what are your like actionable steps for athletes?
Well, first of all, it would be hard to say that someone is effectively in low energy availability for the reasons that I said before. But, you know, let's assume the hypothetical scenario where we're certain that someone is being in this place and we're going to do something about it. So you go like, oh, what should we do? Should we tell them to stop training? Should we tell them to eat more or to do both? Yeah, so there's different approaches that you would like to have. You can have, I mean. But it's important that, you know, you are working with endurance athletes, and, you know, if they didn't train for a few hours, they're going to become concerned about them becoming unfit. And so you can go and, you know, look at the guidelines of sort of return to play of, you know, the female athlete triad sort of consensus statement, or the Red S and so on. And they have a range of criteria that says like, oh, you know, if you're in this situation, you should stop and then, you know, go back only once, you know, this, that, and that is achieved and so on. So I'm no one to say and criticize this. Of course, you got to see what the etiology of the problem is. If it's an eating disorder, of course, you know, you got to take care of that and stuff. But yeah, we need to consider that, for example, the source of the problem is, let's say, purely physiological and is an energy imbalance. There's no psychological problems generating this. So what we begin to think about then is that if we go from a more sort of theoretical perspective, the problem is energy. So we have to think about increasing that amount of energy so we could potentially achieve, you know, normal physiological function upon increasing the amount of energy available simply by eating more. So for many athletes, that might be a challenge. And then it becomes more of a logistical challenge of how do we eat more? So we need to eat more energy in general. What is this energy needs to be composed of? Exactly, we don't know. We don't know if this is something that can be resumed by simply increasing the energy in general, so we can eat more fat, or is both fat or carbohydrate, or is predominantly carbohydrates. So from what we know from endurance athletes is that, as I was saying before, typically they don't eat enough carbohydrates, at least compared to what we think is ideal based on the guidelines. So that might be a nice starting point. So increase to eat more. How much more? Well, we don't really have a measure for this. We can try to do whatever is achievable for the athlete. It could be that, you know, this athlete, for example, when they go on a bike ride, they don't eat anything. And then you might try to fit that with eating around, you know, 60 grams of carbohydrates per hour, which, you know, most athletes would be okay dealing with that at the beginning, assuming they don't have any sort of phobia to eating more food or more carbohydrates. So simply by increasing energy intake, in some cases, could potentially be a way of solving this problem. Although we don't really have enough evidence to say, well, this is for definite the case, or exactly how much energy someone should be having. Of course, if you decrease the energy expenditure from exercise, that might help a little bit as well, because from what we know, at least theoretically, it's not the stress of exercise that is causing this problem, but it's the energy imbalance. And this is the early question that happened about this, when they were saying like female athletes not being able to have their normal menstrual cycle, was like, oh, is it like the fact that, you know, they're exercising that produces a hormonal change, and then this got like changes in body temperature, you know, dehydration, you name it, you know, different range of things. And then, you know, there was a range of studies showing that it was not the stress of exercise, but the actual energy availability. That is why it's such a topic that is so interesting, or there's so much focus on that on its own.
Yeah. So finally, what would your advice be for athletes who might be intimidated by the thought of increasing or ensuring that they have adequate energy availability?
Yeah. So I can get in trouble if I say what I really think.
No, you could say it.
Do you reckon? So I think that we need to, of course, it's important, you know, we have to be aware of, we have to be aware that it can cause problems to many people. It can be severe enough to, for it to deserve attention, particularly when it comes to, eliciting problems that might potentially be irreversible to some extent, such as I was saying, you know, the decreasing bone mineral density and stress fractures and so on. I wouldn't be otherwise, and of course, you know, you gotta make sure that you don't have someone who's got an eating disorder, because, you know, that is a different problem altogether. I mean, they're associated, but we're talking about, like, here purely about energy. I'm not going to the topic of eating disorder, because it's a really, really fascinating topic. Mm-hmm. So let's say we're certain that it's not an eating disorder, the problem. It's more maybe, you know, related to energy. I wouldn't be necessarily too concerned about it in general. With the caveats of what I said before, that it can cause a problem. So if it's something that maybe happens acutely, you know, it's okay. But then, you know, what you have to be aware of is something that is not becoming a chronic problem. I think one of the things that you have to be really taking care of is the carbohydrate intake, to make sure, you know, the muscle glycogen stores are replenished and so on. So your performance is not going to suffer. And this is sort of an easy win, you know, in the majority of the cases. If you're doing nutrition with an endurance athlete, you know, low hanging fruit in the majority of the cases is like they're not eating enough carbs. So what I'm trying to say here is that, of course, keep an eye out, you know, be aware that this can cause a potentially significant problem, but it doesn't happen from one day to the other. You know, it takes time. And of course, you want to be, you know, more, you know, if you're an elite performance athlete, it's a necessity for you to optimize body composition, in which case, in many cases, it might require a degree of body composition manipulation. So you cannot be fearful of this all the time, but you have to be aware that, you know, if you're going to walk on a razor's edge, that this, you know, you can go too far in one direction, right? So this would be my sort of general idea about what you should be and not be doing.
Yeah, super helpful. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been so informative. Where can our athletes keep up to date with your work? It sounds like you have a lot of exciting research in the pipeline.
Yeah, we have a lot of work in the pipeline. So we hope that this year some very exciting research is going to be published. So, but you never know, you know, the nature of the beast, the academic world, like things tend to take longer than you hope they would. I have a Twitter account which is JL Areta. That is JLAreta. They can find me there. I'm not like super active on Twitter, but I, you know, tweet every now and then. And ResearchGate, you know, PubMed and all these memes and, you know, set alerts for my name. And you can find, you know, when something new gets published, it's going to, an alert's going to come up there.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.